We got to get ourselves back in the mode because last week was Easter, so we did not cover anything in Joshua, so we had to go back 2 weeks to get us into the frame of mind. 2 weeks ago, the last one in this series, we saw not only did Israel cross the Jordan River, but while they were crossing the Jordan River, God had instructed Joshua to instruct the guys from each of the tribes to pick up a stone, carry it up out of the Jordan River, up to the bank, then carry it to the place we're going to be today in our text, to Gilgal, where they made a memorial, a monument of those 12 stones, to always remember the day that God entered them through the Jordan River into the promised land to fulfill his promises to his people. And just like they memorialize that with these stones, in all of chapter 4, they talk about these 12 stones time and time and time again. You know, we ought to also be marking those events where God shows up in our lives that is undeniable, and to do it in such a manner that not only us personally can remember, but that we can then share with other people what God has done for us in our lives. And so the people have crossed the Jordan River on dry ground during flood season when God stopped up the river with the Ark of the Covenant and let the people cross, and they get into the official promised land when they cross onto the other Jordan, the bank of the Jordan River, and they set up camp on the plains of Jericho, which should remind you that not that many chapters ago, but a lot of the things have happened since then, that Joshua had sent two spies into Jericho to just see what the case was. And they brought back a very positive report that even Rahab said that the people here are heavily discouraged. They've lost heart. They are not feeling good about the fact that you and your God are coming, and we know that we're coming, that you're coming for us. And so Rahab asks for them to save her and her household when they do come. But still, we are not ready to fight the battle of Jericho. Anybody else confused about how long it's taking us to get to Jericho? I mean, like, we introduced it, I think, in chapter 2, and we still aren't there. Like, when we think of the story of Joshua, like, we think it like, Moses dies, Joshua's in charge, go kill everything in Jericho. Like, that's at least how I think of it. But there is a lot that is taking place before the battle of Jericho. And so here we are in Joshua chapter 5 today. And although the bookends of our passage today are kind of awkward in subject material, as well as the fact that it doesn't seem quite long enough, that what takes place in these 10 verses, verses 2 through 12, are important to God and to his people when they enter into the promised land. So I'm aware that this is not your typical, like, feel-good sermon text, and I'll try to not oversell it, but these things are important, and so I want us to understand it, because for us, not being Jewish and being of the New Testament, we can look at this and we're like, okay, yeah, it's another circumcision passage. Could we just skip it? Because I think a lot of us would be a whole lot more comfortable if we did. But we are not going to, because it is something that is important, just like these 12 stones that they kept bringing up over and over again. Because the crossing of the Jordan River, it's a big deal. They could have just said they made a monument of stones and moved on, and they didn't. They took special note of the process by which these 12 stones came out of the Jordan River and became a monument to God's goodness to his people. So, Joshua chapter 5, if you're wondering, verse 1, we said, was on the tail end of chapter 4. It's a really good transition, so, you know, put it the last verse of 4, first verse 5. But after the people had crossed over the river, all the people of the land had experienced the Jordan River in flood stage doing things it doesn't normally do. People north were confused because it was extra flooded, like flooded way beyond their, like, normal flood buffer. And they were confused. And the people downriver were confused because suddenly the water stopped coming. And so the people of the land all get together, and it says the Amorite kings and all the other kings, Canaanite kings near the sea, the Mediterranean Sea, they get together and they figured out, like, okay, well, now the people of God are across the river and something happened in this general area. And they were discouraged. Their hearts melted and their courage failed because of what Yahweh had done for his people, and now they are inside the boundaries of their land and they don't know what to do. But verse 2, God is not ready to tell his people, go take everything. They have to obey God's commands. And so in verse 2, the Lord said to Joshua, make flint knives and circumcise the Israelite men again, or for a second time. To which we'd all be like, really? A second time? Good news, the next couple verses explain what God meant by a second time. So Joshua made flint knives, circumcised the Israelite men at Gibeath Haraloth, which you can all look up the meaning of that later. And this is the reason Joshua circumcised the Israelite men a second time, because all the people who came out of Egypt, all the who were males, men of war, had died in the wilderness along the way after they had come out of Egypt. So remember, Moses led the people out of slavery in Egypt for 400 years after the 10 plagues that God sends on to Egypt, and they go out, right? And at that time, all of the Israelite men were circumcised as they should have been. And that marked them as God's people. Now that being said, circumcision was generally well practiced in various nations, not all nations, but God, when he made his covenant with Abraham, said that the mark of this covenant people is that of circumcision. And so the Israelite people, even when they're in slavery, they were practicing the sign of the covenant. And the people left Egypt, walked through the Red Sea and into the wilderness to receive God's law at Mount Sinai. Then they marched to the land, the southern border. And God says, all right, time to go into the land. And they're like, but there's some giants and big cities. Like, we can't take them. And so then God sends them out into the wilderness for a generation for 40 years until that generation died off. Okay, we'll come back. But the case was that the people who left Egypt, the men who were the men of war, were circumcised as they should have been. But verse 6, the Israelites wandered in the wilderness 40 years until all the nation's men of war who came out of Egypt had died off, because they did not obey the Lord by going into the land. Instead said, that's a bad idea. So the Lord vowed never to let them see the land he had sworn to their fathers to give us, a land flowing with milk and honey. Interesting note. Canaan is often described as a land of flowing of milk and honey, and that has always confused me, all right? Because I don't know if you know this, but milk doesn't, like, flow in streams. comes from animals, surprise. So the remark that the land is flowing with milk is actually telling the reader and the people that the land is very good for them, typically goat milk. So that the land is good for raising goats is what that, but land flowing with milk sounds a whole lot better than the land's good for goats. And then the remark of honey, everybody disagrees about that, whether it's about bees and honey or the sweet nectar of other, the whole point is there's flowering produce all over the place that even the bees have enough to make extra honey, or if it is just the nectar of the dates and stuff. But it's obvious from context. It's supposed to say it's a very good land. But flowing with milk always threw me for a loop. So thought maybe you'd be interested. So God told the first nation, the first generation of the nation of Israel that came out of slavery that was circumcised, that they could not enter the land because they did not obey him when he told them to enter. And so he sent them into the wilderness until they died off. And verse 7, Joshua raised up their sons, the sons of the rebellious generation, in their place. And it was these, those sons of the rebellious people, that he circumcised. They were still uncircumcised since they had not been circumcised along the way. In case you were wondering, they didn't circumcise while they were wandering in the wilderness. That's what that verse means. This is using the word circumcised a whole lot. Verse 8, after the entire nation had been circumcised, they stayed where they were in the camp, Gilgal, until they recovered. The Lord then said to Joshua, today I have rolled away the disgrace of Egypt from you. Therefore, that place is called Gilgal to this day. All right, so I think we generally followed the storyline. Israelites that were in slavery, they were circumcised. They went to the land. They didn't go in. God said, you can't go in now because you didn't do what I told you to do. Out to the wilderness you go. We're going to raise up the next generation. The next generation were uncircumcised because they were wandering around in the wilderness for 40 years. Then God brings them into the land because they obeyed when God said go. When the Jordan River stopped, the people hurried across. There wasn't this delay of, I don't know, because the other side of the Jordan River, there's a Jericho over there. I'm not so sure about this. The people went with great haste, but they were uncircumcised. And so now they're in the land that God had promised to his people, and circumcision is the mark of who is God's covenantal people. And so they're in the land, although they are uncircumcised. But the circumcised generation didn't get into the land because they didn't obey God. And so now God comes to Joshua and says, all right, they have inherited the promise, but now they need to be part of the covenant that I have made with their forefather Abraham. And so in order to do that, we must mark them. And so he tells Joshua to circumcise the men now that they have entered into the land to be part of God's people and be marked. They must be circumcised. And so they do. In verse 9, it says, God comes to Joshua and says, today I have rolled away. Anyone else have an interesting translation there? I think you should all say rolled away, because that's the literal thing that it's saying. Rolled away the disgrace of Egypt from you, the people, and therefore that place is called Gilgal. Well, the name Gilgal I'm not good at Hebrew, so you ask Michael later. But the way you say Gilgal and the verb roll away, they sound similar. So it'd be like a poetic way, or if you like spoken word, things like that, you can say the word just slightly off so that it sounds like that. So Gilgal gets its name from God saying, I have rolled away. That's what Gilgal means, rolled away. Just like the song, rolled away, rolled away. All right, God says, I have rolled away the disgrace of Egypt from you. The people have entered into a different chapter now. There's a chapter of slavery. There's a chapter of Exodus. Then there's the chapter of the wilderness wandering, where because of their disobedience and not entering the land, there was a delay. And now they have entered into a new chapter of inheriting the land, and God has says, therefore I have rolled away the disgrace of Egypt from you. Let's talk briefly about the disgrace of Egypt. Only the oldest of the people remaining at this point would have had a slight notion of what life was like in slavery. They all knew what it was like to wander around the desert, going from place to place, waiting for people to die. But very few of them knew what it was like to be slaves in Egypt. It is much more likely that instead of rolling away the disgrace of Egypt being a removal of your slavery, although that's part of it, is that Moses argued with God multiple times that if God didn't bring the people into the land, that Egypt would hear about it, they would know about it, and they would say, well, their God was powerful enough to get them away from Pharaoh, but not powerful enough to get them all the way to Canaan. And it would be a disgrace, not just to the people, but to God himself. And so Moses had that conversation with God on couple different occasions where God says, I'm going to just wipe out everybody and start all over again with you. And Moses is like, yeah, don't do that, because if we die out here in the wilderness and we never get into the land, Egypt's going to hear about it and they're going to mock you. And everybody listens to Egypt. So he says that today I have rolled away the disgrace of Egypt from you. And God says, I have accomplished. Egypt's got nothing to say now. Now, it took us 40-something years, but Israel, you are in the land. Egypt has nothing mocking to say about me or about you. And so the removal of this disgrace is tied to circumcision, the removal and the sign of being marked as God's people because they have entered into this land that God has promised them. And then the next couple of verses, talk about after they had done this, which is another reason why circumcision must take place first, is because they're about to celebrate Passover, and they're finally in the land, and a prerequisite to people observing Passover was that they would be circumcised. Even if they weren't Israelites by birth, they were to be circumcised before observing Passover. And so we had remarked that when they had crossed was the day that they were to select the lamb to offer and to eat for their Passover meal, and now it is time for them to observe Passover. So they camped at Gilgal while waiting to recover from circumcising everybody. On the plains of Jericho, there's this flat region from Jericho to the Jordan River, and there they kept the Passover on the evening of the 14th day of the month, which, if, in case you're wondering, that is the prescribed day. That's when they were supposed to do it, and they did it. Looking good so far, right? Jordan River opens, they run across. They get across, they're like, we're going to circumcise everybody. And everyone's like, cool, let's do it. And then they get to Passover, and they're like, all right, let's do it right. And so they do. The day after Passover, they ate unleavened bread, which is what they're supposed to do, and also roasted grain from the produce of the land. They had left the wilderness where nothing grew, and now they're across the Jordan River, and they're into a land where they can eat unleavened bread and just produce, just all millions of them, cross the land, and now they're eating from the produce of the land. And the day they ate from the produce of the land, the manna ceased. Remember when Israel left Egypt, they were walking through the wilderness where things didn't grow, and they had a good number of people with them and trying to feed them all. And it was only made worse by the fact that they didn't enter the land the first time, because it didn't take them all that long to go from Egypt, get the laws of God, gather a people, and go to the land the first time. But then they had to do this for 40 years. And for 40 years, God did not let his people starve in the wilderness. For 40 years, God made sure that their shoes didn't wear out, that their feet weren't swollen. For 40 years, God provided water where they had no business finding water. For 40 years, God protected them from enemies that sought to take advantage of them while they were out in the open with nowhere to run, nothing to survive off of, and God kept them alive. Not just them, but their animals too. God faithfully provided for his people day in and day out. The only day manna had never fallen was on the Sabbath day. And God gave very specific instructions about gathering manna, not to have extra by the end of the day, except for on Friday night, you know, make sure you have enough to make it all the way through Saturday. God had provided food for his people where there was no food, and kept them alive until he could fulfill his promise to have them in the land. And when they made it to the land, they didn't need manna anymore, because God, for generations, had been preparing the land for the entrance of his people so that they would enter during the flood season, during the harvest season, so that when they crossed, they would no longer need the little grains they found on the ground every morning, that they could just wake up, walk 12 feet, and eat food. No more gathering instructions, no more weighing, trying to make sure you had the exact right amount, making sure you clean out your thing. You just walked outside and you ate whatever you saw. Because God, for generations, had been prepping the land for his people, so that when they came, the food would be there, just as he prepared the manna for the Israelites. And since there was no more manna for the Israelites, they ate from the crops of the land of Canaan that year. Crops that they didn't plant. They didn't weed. They didn't fret about. They didn't water. They didn't worry if there was hail. They just walked in and said, this is ours, because God has provided it for us. And so although this marks the turning of the chapter, that the manna ceasing seems like such a downer, because it is a daily provision that God had made for his people, let's be honest, after 40 years of eating manna, how many different ways can you prep that thing? It was probably a good variety to show up in Canaan and say, hey, you know, here's a thing I haven't eaten in a while, or maybe never. Because if you were born on the way and you entered in, manna was the only thing you ever knew. And that you have been told since you were born that you are being marched to a land that we can't go into yet, but it's flowing of milk and honey, and they probably were just as confused about that as I am. But God had prepared the land for his people, and they have entered it, and they entered it through obedience, and they have celebrated the Passover to remember 40-something years ago when their forefathers left Egypt. As slaves, they left and into the land, and God made his people a people. He gave them a law. He gave them leaders. He gave them a religious system. He gave them a civil system that they were to take with them into the land. And all of these people understood the cost of disobedience because the generation before them had cost them 40 years of living in this land. It was flowing milk and honey because they didn't obey God. And so Joshua chapter 5, verses 2 through 12 is a moment for this generation to actually turn the page. And you see them do it full-heartedly with no hesitation, but do not lose the fact that what they did is pretty big. Because here's the deal. If circumcision is the mark of God's people, the mark of the covenant God had made with Abraham, that even Abraham, while he was old, got circumcised, that the circumcision marked God's people, you see the paradox of those who were marked as God's people not entering God's land because they disobeyed and they lacked faith. But then a whole generation of guys born in the wilderness, wandering around from Egypt all the way to the land, went uncircumcised. They were not marked as God's people, although they lived by faith that God would bring them to the land, that he would be their God, that when they made it to the land, they obeyed by faith and crossed the Jordan River on dry ground. And then when Joshua was like, all right, let's get some obsidian out and mark you as God's people, they said, yeah, that's what we've been waiting for. These people demonstrated that they belonged to God, although they were unmarked by their faith and their obedience. Sound like any other character in the story of Joshua we've seen so far? That Rahab, not an Israelite, also not a guy, so doesn't have to worry about that, but was not one of God's people, but through faith and obedience, committed herself to God. That God is far more concerned about his people's devotion than their physical markings. That he isn't using the sign of the covenant as the fulfillment of the covenant. He has formulated this covenant with Abraham before any of these people were around. And God said, I'm going to do it on my own. He's the one that split the animal. Abraham split the animals. He walked through it on his own. But even though that circumcision with the shedding of blood marked people as part of God's covenant, that wasn't good enough for God to just say, sure, you can have whatever you want. Circumcision was a sign of the covenant, but it wasn't your fulfillment of it. That it had to be met with faith and with obedience. Just like Abraham, that before he was circumcised, he had faith and it was credited to him as righteousness. And then he was circumcised. That is still the case for these people. It's still the case for us, although circumcision is no longer the sign of our covenant because we have a new covenant. We have to be marked as God's people, but the thing that marks God's people has always been that they had faith and they obeyed. And ultimately, that is what it means to be part of God's covenantal people, to inherit the promises God gives to his covenantal people. to be brought into the place of rest where you can inherit life. And Jesus would say an abundant life, a fulfilling life with God and for us as a new covenant forever. But you don't get in there because you did a thing. The first generation was a generation that was willing to leave Egypt because they were slaves, but not a generation that was willing to enter the land God had given to them because they didn't believe in him. They saw him leading them through the wilderness, but the second they got to the edge of the land, they're like, that's not a good idea. We don't want to do that. And this generation raised this next generation. I like how in this chapter 5, verse 7, it says that Joshua raised their sons in their place, meaning that the parents should have circumcised their kids. There's some argument there, obviously, like not a great idea that if you're moving place to place to just circumcise people out in the wilderness, but the reality is they stayed in places for a good chunk of time. Also, it's not a great idea to be pregnant, and yet seems like they did just fine doing that, wandering around the wilderness for 40 years. But this rebellious generation did not, knowing that they wouldn't inherit the promise, did nothing to pass on the promise that God had to their generation of kids. And that generation, this new generation that finally got to cross the river, had to decide for themselves if they were going to believe God and obey him in whatever he called them to do, because the previous generation, although they were marked as God's people, fell short of being God's people because they didn't have faith, they didn't believe, and they didn't obey. And they passed away in the wilderness. Now this generation makes it into the land and is willing to be marked as God's people. So as we consider this, we have to understand that things are different now than they were then, because God's people isn't just a national identity. It's not just this fulfillment of God getting his people into the specific part of the world that he had designed for them to be so that they could be in the presence of God, that Jesus came on the scene and upped the ante of all of these promises time and time again. That we get to be God's people, although we had no business being God's people, although we were not marked as God's people, the same way that these people, this generation, became marked as God's people through our faith and obedience. And our new Joshua, Jesus, is the one that we have faith and we follow. Jesus is on the scene and he sacrifices himself as a Passover lamb so that our sins could be removed and rolled away. Just like the arguments that Egypt would have against God, Jesus says, you know what? I'll do one better. And if you want this one better thing, go to Colossians. Paul does a great job of saying, look, Jesus took away, removed from us our debt of sin, nailed it to the cross. He ripped it, removed it from us, and now we are God's people because of him. And if we believe in Jesus and then do what he says and follow him and become more like him, we then express to ourselves and to the world, we belong to him. We are his people, and we will get whatever he's getting because he has made us his very own. At his own cost, that Jesus shed the blood in order to start this new covenant, that those who are outside of the normal natural boundaries of God's people could be brought in so that we as Gentiles, thousands of years later, get to now be part of God's family, because if we believe and follow Jesus, we inherit his promises. There is something to be said, because as generations come and generations go, and it has been quite a while since Jesus was here on earth, that some of us, like myself, grew up in a Christian house where both parents, both sets of grandparents were Christians. And they don't do what's right all the time either, just like we don't. But there is the question of, are you a member of God's covenant and his people? Because what is told to us here is that what you look at is not always the determining factor of if you are or are not part of God's family. Because the whole generation of slaves that left Egypt, they did everything they were told to. They were circumcised. They made it to the land. But they didn't obey because they lacked faith. And then the next generation of people who grew up walking around the desert, who were not circumcised, made it to the land. God opened the door for them into the land. And they went in. And they ate the produce of the land. And so it is not what the previous generation has or has not done that matters to if you can be or are not a member of God's covenant. God is very much concerned with you. He's concerned about the whole, but nothing that a previous generation did or didn't do gets to determine if you belong to God or not. It is through faith and obedience you become part of God's family. And you can decide to do that. You can decide to do it regardless of what your family did or didn't do. Whether you grew up Christian, whether you grew up completely atheist or nobody cared, it doesn't matter, because God's offer through Jesus is to everyone. Not just to the Israelites. Just like we see in Joshua, that Rahab, not an Israelite, was welcomed into the covenant of God's people in the land because she obeyed and had faith. That is what marks us, is what we believe in our hearts, our souls, and also our actions that display to each other and to the rest of the nations around us who we belong to. Now, I don't want us to miss that, like the 12 stones is a physical reminder, and circumcision clearly is a physical reminder. Time and time again, the New Testament authors refer to circumcision and the new covenant, but they often are taking the idea that God puts here, I have removed, rolled away the disgrace of Egypt, to say that circumcision and the new covenant of a new heart is a circumcision of the heart, the removal of our sin from us, which is what Jesus accomplished on the cross. But we would be remiss if we also had no physical reminder of what God has done to us by bringing us into his family, by removing our sin, by putting it on Jesus. Which is why a lot of times the New Testament authors will talk about circumcision and baptism in the same sentence, like it's like you should know what you're talking about. Like you should automatically know what's going on. And the reason is because in the new covenant, Jesus has circumcised our hearts, but circumcision of the heart isn't something you get to see. It's not actual heart surgery where you got to get a nice scar here. But there is a physical marking of God's people through what we as New Testament believers demonstrate in baptism. That the removal of sin is something God has done, that pushing someone underwater doesn't actually accomplish. But what it does do is gives you the physical markings. It gives you the ability to bear witness to what is true. And you want to be a little bit more uncomfortable. Circumcision wasn't a private thing done in the hospital room somewhere. Done correctly, there were witnesses. It was done on a specific day. There was like a party for it. Okay? It is similar to that of baptism. It is not that you were circumcised and that people would go around checking all the time. They knew because so-and-so was there and celebrated it while it happened. And baptism carries on that sign as well, that you wouldn't know if I was baptized or not just by looking at me. You'd probably be able to tell if I'd showered in the last week, but you're not going to know if I was baptized 10 years ago. But the way that you know that I embraced Jesus, that I am trying my best to follow him in obedience, is that I chose to be baptized to demonstrate what Jesus had done, which was remove my sin by burying it, as another New Testament author would talk about baptism, being baptized into his death. Just removed. He circumcised my heart, took away the disgrace of the sin that was rightfully mine. He took it away. He took it with him, and he left it apart from me. It was detached from me. And now the mark that I get to use to celebrate that, thankfully, is baptism. It is something that reminds you of what Jesus did. But I also want us to understand that although I'm a Baptist, and we're really into the whole baptism thing, as we should be, it doesn't guarantee anything. The first generation of people were circumcised. They didn't get into the land. They died in the wilderness. And the theme, the motto of that generation was, it would have been better to die in Egypt. Well, maybe it would have been. Maybe it would have been. Because then you can fault God for not bringing you to the land. But you were there and you didn't enter. Although you were primed for it. You were marked. Just like that, if you get baptized, that doesn't mean God has to let you into the promised rest that comes in the future, because it is not the physical marking at all that guarantees you you're part of God's covenant. What guarantees you part of God's covenant is your faith and obedience to him. He says that if you have faith and obedience, I will bring you into the land regardless of your marks. So I want to encourage you that you should consider seriously if you, one, are personally living as a covenantal person of God's people, that you are not just riding on the tails of people who have come before you, that their faith was good enough for them, so I'll just keep doing it. Good gospel song, bad theology lived out in practicality. It is not just, well, my parents raised me to believe in Jesus, so I kind of believe in Jesus, and off I go. You decide if you are going to believe in Jesus and follow him. Secondly, I want to ask you, if you are a part of God's covenantal family because of your faith and obedience, have you done anything to mark it? I understand that baptism is a weird thing culturally, when it wasn't, just like circumcision wasn't a weird thing when they were doing that either. But it is still a reminder of what Jesus has done for us by removing the shame and the guilt, our payment due, our debt, by removing it from us. Baptism pictures that by washing it away. It doesn't do it, but it pictures it. So if you are a member of God's covenantal people, have you marked it? Have you decided to mark it in the way that Jesus established when he was baptized, that we would be baptized like him, to remind us of how God has removed, rolled away the disgrace of our sin and our slavery to sin, and set us on a new trajectory, to a new chapter, to a new path, to cross the Jordan River into the promised land. Because that is how we make it, is by faith. And we demonstrate it through our obedience, and we point to something that says, look, this marked it. I'm part of God's family. So when God says, this is mine, and the whole of the earth is God's, it's ours. And we inherit it because of Jesus, our new Joshua, who bought it on his price with his blood, not our own, so that we could inherit the promised rest that remains for God's people still yet to enter. And we get to be ambassadors now to the people in the land and outside of the land and in your neighborhood, that they too, if they believe and follow after Jesus, can be part of God's covenantal people and eat the produce of a land we have never dreamed about, because we spent the entirety of our lives here in the wilderness, thinking we have it, thinking this is the best that it can be. It's not. It's good. God gives us what we need day to day while we live here in the wilderness, but it is not the promised land. It is better still to come. And we enter the land that is still to come through faith. Not through circumcision, not through baptism, not through donations, not through good works, but through faith in Jesus and his work alone by cutting away our sin, removing the shame and disgrace that our sin and slavery had put on us. And we can celebrate Passover, that Jesus was our Lamb who took away the sin that prevented us from judgment, and we then can celebrate that. Weird, because Passover gets recycled in the New Testament and the New Covenant as communion. That we can celebrate the salvation that God had sent for us, for his people, by making sure that the blood, not ours, could be applied to us so that judgment could pass us, so that we would not die, but instead have everlasting life. Jesus sacrificed himself, shed his blood to institute this new covenant that actually is better than this. Like, this is a great story. The people get into the land, had no business being there, but they get into the land because they just obeyed, because they believe God said to do something, so they said, sure, let's do it. That's a great story, but it's just a minor picture of what will happen in the end. It's a much better story that the people who make it into the land had no business being there. Those who make it to heaven definitely were not born so that they could get into heaven. God worked in their lives. They have faith and they followed him and they made it, even though they had no business being there. And then one of them, I hope, is you. Dear Father, thank you for your word. Even some of the awkward things. That if we understand what you were communicating to your people in their context, that it's not so far for us to stretch to understand what you're communicating to us in our context. We thank you for this faithful generation that obeyed your words, that entered the land through faith, and then also were willing to mark it as though they were part of your covenantal people, that they inherited, that they got to eat the fruit of the land that they had been living for while they were in the wilderness. And we pray that that would be the story of this generation today. That we would disregard the impacts of what has or hasn't been done in previous years, but instead commit ourselves to your covenant, to your people, to the gospel of Jesus, and that we would be passionate in observing it and following you and presenting it to others to be a part of. And as we wait for the day where you will bring us to our final rest in this land with you, with our sin rolled far away from us, that we would begin to live that truth today by going to war and fight against our sin that still tries to cling to us, knowing that we have been declared set free, that Jesus has removed the shame and guilt of our sin. Help us to live as those people who have faith and obedience and commit ourselves and recommit ourselves and recommit ourselves to continue and daily follow you, pick up our cross, and obey what you have us to do. Pray that if anyone here is not or is unsure, if they individually are a part of your covenantal people who have believed in Jesus, that his sacrifice counts for them, that they will follow in obedience, we pray that they would ask any questions they need to ask, that they would choose on their own and not let a previous generation, quote unquote, choose for them, that this faith would be theirs, not their moms, dads, grandmas, step-parents, godparents, but it would be theirs. That you and them can be at peace and not at war, and that they can be set free from the slavery of sin and brought to the promised land, where we will enjoy an abundant life that you have prepared for your people for generations and generations since the beginning and the foundations of the world. We pray that that would change how we live on the day to day, that it would be who we are, not just something that has or hasn't been done to us, that we would live it out so that people could see it. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.